From WGBH, this is Security Mom, a podcast about national security, declassified. I'm Juliette Kayyem.
Actually, people didn't know this, that you were the only cabinet secretary in the transition from Bush to Obama who stayed an extra day.
Right, yeah.
And why was that?
Because we were concerned that if an event happened on the inauguration and you had a new Secretary of Homeland Security who literally had their first day on the job, they'd be all of a sudden confronted with something they had no experience to deal with.
In 2005, Michael Chertoff became the second Secretary of Homeland Security. He served the Bush administration until, as you just heard, the day after President Obama's inauguration in 2009.
Turns out there was a false alarm that day. Better to have us be able to stay over for another half day.
So I worked for you for like a day.
Oh, okay.
You're my best boss ever. I didn't
boss,
get fired.
Right. Easiest boss, yeah.
I got to know Michael pretty well during the transition from Bush to Obama in late 2008. I was one of those newbies during those transition days and would later become Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security. Thanks to the need for secrecy to keep terrorists out of the loop, jobs and Homeland Security are better known for our errors than our successes. This Michael knows. He was Secretary of the Department during its failed response to Hurricane Katrina. But what you may remember most from his time at Homeland is that darn color code system that was meant to warn the public when things got really bad. Red, blue, green, yellow. Was there a purple? The system was seen as flawed not simply by the public or late-night comedians, but by those of us in national security, including, eventually, Chertoff himself.
You know, the original genesis of the alert system is something people have forgotten, but it was not meant to be public. It was originally meant to be an internal mechanism through which you could alert police or other emergency services or critical infrastructure about a threat and then have them raise their preparation and response level. After that was inaugurated very quickly, I think there was an incident out in California. The alert level was raised. I think the governor went out and announced it. And then there was a lot of criticism about the fact that the government was keeping this a secret. And people were saying, well, if you're going to raise the alert level for people in government, shouldn't you let the public know? So then they said, okay, we'll make it public. The problem with making it public is that it doesn't necessarily empower people about what they ought to do. So it was like, oh, here's something you ought to worry about, but we're not being very specific, and we're not giving you any recipe for what you ought to do in terms of response. So when we came in, we thought to ourselves, well, we ought to, A, be more specific,
and
B,
this is in 2004.
In 2005.
So it's been 2005, excuse me. So it's been raised 15 times, or yeah, so it had become sort of caricatured a famous like Saturday Night Live skit, which was my sort of favorite.
What precisely do these threat levels indicate? Condition off white, the lowest level, indicates a huge risk of terrorist attack. Next highest, condition cream, an immense risk of terrorist attack. And finally, the most serious, condition natural, an enormous risk of terrorist attack.
Yeah, well, and you could say there were a couple of things became evident. One is it doesn't make sense to raise it generally. You ought to be more specific about either a location or a part of the, a particular type of function like transportation. So you give people a little bit more guidance. Second, what became evident was the lowest level was green. It was evident we were never going to be in green. So,
this is good for people who don't get it. It's never going to be green because there's always a threat. Then we're never safe.
Green was a theoretical baseline of a world in which there's no terrorism. That's not going to happen.
Or anything, for
correct.
That matter.
Yeah. So then you had yellow and orange. Yellow being kind of some level of threat. Orange being a heightened threat. And then you had red. And the problem is it was very difficult to define what red was. Did red mean an attack is literally going to happen like tomorrow? Did it mean an attack already happened? Once you're at red, how do you come down from red? So we realized pretty quickly that essentially you're really dealing with two states. Yellow is your base, right, and orange is your elevated. And then we tried to be focused on, again, particular regions or particular types of threats. So, for example, we raised it in July of 2005 because there were bombs on subways in London.
Right.
And I went on TV and I said, we're concerned about copycats. We're raising it for the rail sector, the transportation sector, because we think there's some risk that there'll be either a follow-on attack here or a copycat attack.
So you're dealing with terrorism and hurricanes and cyber attacks, whatever. But the challenge for people like you or anyone in this field is just how do you communicate this? Because the truth is you don't know. I mean, you have a sense or maybe some intelligence telling you, but you never get a piece of paper that says there's going to be an attack on July 5th in San Francisco. Raise the color alert.
So there were really, think about it as a matrix where there are two axes. One is the axis of how specific the information is, and the second is the axis of how credible it is. So, for example, if you had information that a particular bus stop is going to be attacked, that's quite specific. But if the source of the information is someone overheard a vague statement in a bar, that's not very credible. At the other extreme, you could have a very credible source, like you're maybe collecting electronic surveillance, that talks about an attack is going to come next week, but it doesn't tell you where or how it's going to happen. So you have to balance those in determining at what point it makes sense to raise the level. Obviously, if you have something that's reasonably specific and reasonably credible, that was the strongest case. Most of the time, you had things that were non-specific and non-credible, and you didn't raise the level.
So at some stage, you just say, this is not working for us, and it just should be scrapped. I mean, also just the atmospherics of it were, by now in 2005, 2006, Tom Ridge, the former secretary, writes his biography of which he specifically accuses the Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, of putting pressure on him to raise a color alert system right before the election. I mean, it was a moment in all of that time. And so you're just getting hit by all these things. I mean, first of all, did Ridge's statement ring true to you? Or
I wasn't involved. I was on the bench as a judge at that point. I would bet if someone said that it was not out of a nefarious effort to manipulate the election, but it might have been out of a concern that an election, and remember, this was the first election since 9/11 for president, there may have been some concern that that would be a moment when terrorists would actually want to make a, quote, statement by carrying out an attack. So I would say it's probably more an excess of anxiety and nervousness than something that was attempting to manipulate the election.
So you know that the color alert has changed. So I'm taking you back and looking up some articles about the color code system. So one of the ones that came up, and I had forgotten this, later on in your term, you say publicly, look, I'm a little bit concerned about this time. I don't remember what time it was. I just have a gut feeling.
Yesterday's statement by the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, that he has a so-called gut feeling that the U.S. could face a terrorist attack this summer. One Democratic congressman challenged Chertoff today by asking, what color code in the national alert system is associated with a gut feeling?
I mean, what did you want to portray? Because you were trying to probably be more realistic, honest.
Actually, there's a little more to the backstory than that. So I think I was giving an interview to the Chicago Tribune, who was an editorial board, and I forget exactly what the circumstance was, but based on what we were hearing from intelligence, there was a reason to believe that there was a somewhat heightened threat environment based on things that were going on overseas. And I wanted to communicate that, but I wasn't going to reveal classified information. So I tried to couch it in terms of, the environment is such that my senses, my intuition is that we're in a heightened threat environment. Now, that's not to say that that's not a reasonable thing to say under the best of circumstances. After years of working with this, I did have the experience and the judgment to be able to determine kind of the quality of what a threat is. And subsequently, because I did get criticism for it, actually found a book that someone had done as a social sciences study that talked about, I think it's called gut feeling, and talked about how intuition actually is a useful guide because what happens is your subconscious processes information more quickly sometimes than your conscious mind does. And, of course, Malcolm Gladwell subsequently wrote a book about that. But actually part of the reason I cast it that way was to avoid having to get into revealing something classified.
So that's kind of new. There was, and this just gets to how hard it is to communicate this stuff to the public. There was another time of which was very appreciated by people who felt that the dialogue had gotten bad, but I want you to talk about it. At one stage, you say in testimony, look, you know, we live in a world in which there's risk, but you said something like, not every bridge is a bridge. And, I mean, essentially you were saying, if the Golden Gate goes down, that's a big deal. If the Podunk Bridge across some small river goes down, less of a big deal.
Well, I also remember relatively early on, people were asking me about why are you investing more in certain types of protection, not in others. I said, look, because if somebody takes down an airplane, that kills 300 people. If someone, takes out an automobile, maybe that kills 3 people. That's bad, but the order of magnitude is right. Different. Well, of course, that violated the kind of premise. Every life is a universe, and therefore, how can you describe even the loss of one life as anything less than maximally significant? The thing is, no rational person, given a choice between investing to protect 100 people and protecting one person, would say, I'm going to protect the one person. But it's a hard conversation because, as with anything else where you're taking risk with life, to acknowledge that there is a risk and life may be lost, but to make a judgment about how much is enough, it seems a little bit callous. But yet it would be irresponsible not to be able to consider magnitude as an element of what you want to make your investment based on.
No, I often think, like, in the homeland, I mean, we struggled this with the next administration is, there's just no concept of acceptable losses. You know, right. You think about a war and you're like, okay, this many troops will die, but it's worth invading France, World War II. You know, when people think about their own children, then there's no acceptable right. losses, right? That's and right. so who are you to say? And that's the right. the challenge
and
you face.
It's fair to say that with respect to one's own family and friends, you're going to be biased, and therefore you shouldn't be making decisions that are focused on your own family and friends. But you still need to make a decision. Not to decide is actually the worst outcome. Yeah. And so when you're weighing degrees of investment with some limit on resources, you do ultimately have to consider numbers as a measure of the magnitude of damage.
But you're not allowed to say it. I mean, that's
but
the.
Julia, you get used to the fact that sometimes, because of politics, sometimes for other reasons, people will jump on everything you say and they'll try to, twist it or jump up and down about it. And if you're not prepared to kind of stand up for what you believe in and articulate it and defend it, then you have no business being in these jobs.
You once said, I remember at a different panel we were at together, you once said, I thought it was very telling. I don't think you meant it about Napolitano. I think you said generally that maybe the best Secretary of Homeland Security is someone who has no political ambitions because you just have to say things that are difficult.
I think there's no question that when you take a job like that, you have to do it on the assumption that it's going to be your last job, meaning you're not using it as a stepping stone for something else because you're going to make people unhappy. You're not giving people good news. You're not distributing benefits. What you're doing is stopping things people won't know about. Now, I will say in fairness that I've discovered since I left that actually remarkably people do express gratitude. I'm still, years after I've left, stopped at airports or in restaurants, and people say, thank you for keeping us safe, thank you for protecting us. And I think actually you undersell the wisdom and the integrity of the American people if you don't understand that they actually do get it and they really do appreciate the fact that people keep them safe. So in some ways you don't want to short sell the sensibilities of the American public.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And so, I mean, and essentially then you're at the department, this thing has got to change. What did you think it had to change to? I mean, if the color code system now is just not viable and you start some process, did you have a sense like, okay, here's a good way to talk to people about risk?
I think what we tried to do, actually, during my term, and I think subsequently it was changed by Secretary Napolitano, is we just didn't use it very much, and we always accompanied, when we did use it, we accompanied the announcement with a discussion with some specificity about what we were doing. So we wouldn't just raise it. We, like in 2005 with the subway bombings, or 2006 when we had the airline plot to blow up airliners coming from London to North America, I actually got on TV and they said, okay, we're raising the alert level. Here's what's going on. So that it was wrapped around a much more specific and verbal description, not merely, oh, we're raising things to yellow or orange, you know, kind of lump it.
Yeah, no, so, I mean, it is true, like, so the color code system had a slow death, so to speak.
Yeah,
I mean, it just basically stopped being used. Your last couple of years, it was never used. Most people thought it was over. And then the new administration, us, we come in and you publicly say, I remember, get rid of this thing because now you can. Mm-hmm. And just an aside, you know how long it took us to get rid of it? It
took a while.
You know why? Because it had so so we moved to the National Terrorist Advisory System and just get rid of the colors. It was meant to be a narrative of what risk was. So I don't know if it would have been better or worse. It's never been used. But one of the reasons why, and you saw this too, was the color code system had so infiltrated every local, state, first responder, police department, the Coast Guard, TSA, that dismantling it, you know, and when I say infiltrated, they trained to it. So what would you do if we went to Red Alert? A funding was tied to it. You could pay New York Police Department more from the Department of Homeland Security. That it took a year and a half to unravel.
I mean, the concept of having one or two elevated stages of alert is not a bad concept. The British still have it. And the functional purpose was to tie it, exactly as you say, to certain training, certain measures operationally you would put into effect if the level went up, and there was a funding stream attached to it. I think what was unhelpful and was I was glad to see eliminated was the color element, which was, you know, designed to kind of maybe was a little oversimplified, and also having a broad general statement, we're raising it across the country. If you're more specific and you explain why, then I think the a lot of the mysticism dissipates, and then there's actually a functional value.
Yeah. And the one thing that it did change was knowing that, I should say, Secretary Chertoff and Secretary Rich were very helpful to the new administration in terms of, you know, here's what's not working and here's what we have to do, was the challenge that both you and Rich had fallen into or faced, which is once you raise it, you can't lower it.
Well,
it's really hard.
I mean, that was a big debate. for example, with the airline plot, I think we went to red. Because we actually disrupted a plot that was within days of being carried out. And we probably kept it there for a little while until we determined that we had wrapped up everybody, like for a day or two.
Right.
But a lot of times the problem was exactly how do you climb down? And that was one of the defects in the system.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the fix, people wondering, the fix was if ever this new threat system was activated, it would automatically go down after 2 weeks because how hard it was to say there's an all clear, because there's never an all clear in given the world that we're in.
That's right.
Yeah. So because people need to know that we're humans too and people have been in these positions. So you have – your kids were youngish when you were secretary. They're now oldish. No, they're in their 20s. Yeah. And so how do you to have your father as Secretary of Homeland Security when they're at this time, where they're sort of old enough to know what's going on, but you also want everything to be safe for them. I mean, how did you – it must have been sort of bizarre to talk to them about things going on or talk to them.
You probably remember. A lot of people don't. In addition to 9/11 and all the terrorism stuff, during that period of time, particularly when I was down – from 2001 to 2002, we had the anthrax attacks, and people were told you can't open the mail. And then for a long time when I was in office, the mail actually came through a particular location where they irradiated it to kill any anthrax in it. And then there was a sniper. And for many kids in the Washington area, the sniper was actually a more real and protracted trauma because, you know, they were told you can't have soccer. If there's shooting at the school, go into the coat closet. So I think like many kids, you know, my kids grew up with the fact that there was a lot of uncertainty and risk.
How old were they on 9/11?
They were basically middle schoolers.
Yes, yeah, so well aware.
Yeah. So, and of course, you know, people had friends whose parents, you know, were involved as well. And, you know, we originally came from New Jersey, and there were people we knew from New Jersey who lost loved ones in the World Trade Center. So I think it left a mark on everybody. But, you know, you try to teach people the response is not to be fearful, but it's to be thoughtful and to recognize whenever you do something, ask yourself, okay, what's the risk, and is it worth taking? And if it is, how do I prepare myself? And to me, that's empowering as opposed to debilitating.
And that's what you talk to them about in terms of any risk that they're going to take.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've tried by example as well, again, not to be get them to feel timid, because they're not. Yeah. They've traveled. They've done all kinds of things. But just say, think about it and prepare. If you're going to go somewhere, what's your plan? What are you going to do to if something happens? And, you know, it's like what we tell people across the country when we prepare for any kind of emergency, whether it's a natural disaster or something else. There's a lot of value in planning. And, you know, we have, like a lot of people at home, we have, you know, some extra food supplies and medical kit and things that we could live on if there was an interruption of service for a couple of days. We have a generator. So, you know, we try to live, maybe we're not perfect at it, we try to live the preparation and planning mantra, which I think is the key to managing risk.
In a big emergency like a hurricane or a snowstorm or a terrorist attack, government resources are going to be stretched thin, really thin. And we can't all be calling 911 expecting the police or the firefighters or the EMTs just to show up because we need them. And so the more we can do to help ourselves and to help them, the more they can focus their limited resources on people who actually need help or those who are unable to help themselves. Okay, I know this can get scary now about sort of preparing your house for the big event, but it's really very, very easy. Get some spare water and some dry food for the basement. Get those things your kids are going to want if they're home for a couple days. Batteries and flashlights, of course, but something like Pepto-Bismol really also helps because diarrhea can lead to dehydration. Make copies of you and your family's birth certificates and Social Security cards, and don't leave them next to the originals. Mail them out of state so that they are far away should something happen to you or your community. And then just map out your plans with your kids, with people who help you. What are you going to do if cell service is down? What are you going to do if the electricity is down? It's not that hard. Sit down, make a plan, be prepared. Well, I want to thank you, Secretary Chertoff, for, I guess, talking to us about talking about terrorism, and I appreciate it a lot. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be on. And
it was great working for you.
Well, it was great having you for one day, and you've had a great career. You've done a lot in this area, and it's really important to educate families. You know, here's what it's about. People have to be empowered. They shouldn't view risks as, my God, I can't control anything in my life. Let me just, you know, hide under the covers. It should be understanding risk gives me the power to decide for myself what risks I want to take and how do I prepare myself so that I can manage the risks if they come to pass. And I think with that attitude, there are many great opportunities out there to travel and to engage online and offline as long as you have your wits about you.
After Michael Chertoff left his position as Secretary of Homeland Security in 2009, he went on to found a successful security consulting and private equity business. Communicating risk may not be best described with the color scheme, but the challenge of how to talk about this still remains. We have never lived in a world of green alert. Elevated threat is always our base, and that's okay, because that seems to me to be what I do every day at home. I have three kids, after all. I am always living in an elevated threat state. I have no doubt that I could spend my time with them worried about the monsters under their beds. But I think they would be better off if I just shared with them Michael's advice to have your wits about yourself. Our wits. Is that a hunch? A gut feeling? A hue? Maybe it's just honesty. Next time on Security Mom, I'll be talking with my friend Emily Bazelon. She's a writer for the New York Times, and you may know her from Slate's Political Gabfest. We're going to be talking about our kids and their security on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat. Are there any new social media platforms, Cecilia? Snapchat?
Yik Yak.
What?
Yik Yak.
Yik Yak, what's that?
I don't know. I just, a lot of kids do it in my school.
Yik Yak, okay. I don't know. Yik Yak, whatever it is that they're on that I know nothing about. You can find links to Stitcher and iTunes and SoundCloud and past episodes of Security Mom on our website. That's wgbhnews.org/securitymom.
If you liked this episode, please subscribe to Security Mom in iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a review. It makes it easier for people to find our next podcast. Abby Ruzicka is our producer. We had editing help from Peter Katsas and Edgar B. Herwick III. Engineer Alan Mattis helped us mix this episode, and special thanks to Dion Lefkowitz. I'm Juliet Kayyem. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Juliet, K-A-Y-Y-E-M. You can also email me at securitymom@wgbh.org.